The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you looking for more customers for your business? Are you facing new competitors, not just across town, but across the country? How about across borders? How about worldwide? Welcome to Global Reach with your host, Tay Revez. As new technology makes it easier to connect with your customers, it also makes it easier for international competitors to reach them. Our program will help you stay competitive in a tough marketplace. Now, here's your host, Tay Revez.
Welcome back to Global Reach, everyone. This is the show that helps you assess the risks and opportunities in your cross-border business. And few things are bigger risk than violence that occurs within state along with various fault lines. This is a show I've been dying to do for the past 3 months, and I'm here with my guest, Dr. Terrence McNamee. He is the author of the most provocative book that I hope you're all going to read. It's the co-editor. It's called On the Fault Line, Managing Tensions and Divisions Within Societies. Welcome from South Africa, Dr. McNamee.
It's great to be with you, Tay.
A little bit about our guest before we get started. He was educated at universities in Canada and the UK. He was director of the Royal United Services Institute in London for several years, and he's conducted research on security and development issues in numerous fragile states around the world. I have to tell you, this is a stunning book, and if you want to do business in Africa, in the Middle East, and other societies rent with fault lines, and almost all societies have them, you want to read this for an in-depth understanding of the countries they profile and for a terrific analytical framework in looking at any other country, particularly emerging countries that you want to go into. So let's get started. Terrence, tell us about the project. How did you start looking at the fault lines in countries?
Well, I think when we started to do that, we first asked ourselves the question, what's new? What would a project like this tell us about the world that we don't already know? We all know that when war breaks out, it breaks out for a reason. And certainly, given the nature of media and news reporting today, that explanation, that reason comes across to us in our living rooms or in front of our computers as pretty straightforward, pretty readily comprehensible. So, for instance, we will know by looking at the news what's causing the violence in northern Nigeria. It's a clear-cut case of Muslims versus Christians. Or we'll know that in 2011, Sudan split in two because it was an obvious schism between Africans on one side of the fault line and Arabs on the other side of the fault line. And then that fault line fatally erupted, so the state split in two. But what our early research suggested was that the idea that these divisions, these fault lines in societies, are clear-cut and straightforward is actually totally misplaced. Indeed, one of the most important findings of the book is that very often when war breaks out, what we assume to be driving the conflict and igniting the conflict, say religious or ethnic differences, is in fact really just the overlay to the more fundamental tensions, the more fundamental abrasions that lie beneath. So what we did is we gathered a whole bunch of experts, academics, policymakers, and so forth, to look at a number of cases, not just in Africa, but there's a preponderance of cases in Africa, but across the world, and look at how countries manage their fault lines and what are the consequences of good governance or bad governance in terms of managing those fault lines. And the project lasted for 18 months. We had three meetings in three continents. And then we narrow it down for this book to 12 or 13 case studies, mostly country case studies, half of them from Africa. And myself and my colleague Greg Mills, who's the director of the Brentford Foundation, as an editor. And then Jeffrey Herbst, who's one of America's premier Africanists, and he's also the president of Colgate University. He's my other co-editor. So this is what we did, and the book came out in early 2012. And we think it does make a contribution in a practical sense in terms of looking at these societies where we assumed very, very obvious reasons why they might be collapsing and so forth. But this problematizes that whole issue.
Now, all societies have fault lines, but talk about what are the kinds of fault lines that can rend a society or a group so that you have the potential for violence. Can you give us talk about what some of these are? I think the first step, when I looked at the book, there were communal fault lines.
Sure. Well, I think, Kay, what's conveyed throughout the book are a number of different kinds of fault lines. So, for instance, you have fault lines that might be rooted in ethnicity or language or religion or geography or power or class and so forth. But very, very importantly is that these fault lines are rarely in existence in isolation from one another. In fact, what they often do is they crisscross each other, they overlap, and sometimes they reinforce one another. So a country like Nigeria would be a terrific example where there's all kinds of divides that crisscross what is commonly assumed to be a clear Muslim-Christian. But of course, there's geographic, there's power, there's all kinds of fault lines that crisscross in that particular society. So there's a number of different kinds of fault lines, but I think what the book is trying to emphasize is that what we often assume to be driving or igniting the conflict is really not just one fault line. In fact, it might be another, or it might be a whole series of fault lines that are crisscrossing one another.
I would guess that if you have one or two or three different kinds of fault lines or more, that they actually have a multiplier effect.
Absolutely. So you have a case, for instance, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which has been riven by conflict for 100 years. In fact, what is really the key cause, according to Pierre Engelbert in his chapter in the book, is just local issues, local conflict that really don't relate to ethnic issues, tribal issues, and so forth. It actually relates to access of resources and the very, very unfair allocation and distribution of resources in that society.
So what factors are the most predictive of pending violence in a society?
Well, the predictive element is obviously such a crucial one, and I think there's no way, you know, a social scientist can say with any certainty in terms of, oh, well, if you have an existence of certain number of fault lines, then you're bound to have violence. And in fact, some of the best research on ethnic differences shows that by itself, ethnic differences do not overwhelmingly produce conflict. But I think that what you would take away from the book is one of the big predictors of violence is what we call the constituency of losers. And that is, if the number of people in a society who feel that the allocation of resources is unfair, it's corrupt, then if that constituency is large, they are very, very likely to threaten social order. And conversely, in terms of managing those fault lines, if you keep that constituency of losers to a relatively low level, then they're unlikely to be able to initiate violence, which is self-sustaining. So it's an interesting case in Nigeria, where the very, very horrific and terrible Muslim-Christian violence that we see in parts of the north and cities like Jos, in reality, will that destabilize the whole nation? Will large numbers of people be able to mobilize along those religious lines? Probably not in the case of Nigeria. Nigeria is a much more resilient state. So in terms of the predictors of when a society is really going to succumb in the way that Rwanda did, or Nigeria in the 1970s, or Yugoslavia, or other countries and stuff, it's very, very difficult. We often assume it's a pure case of ethnic difference, but the research suggests that ethnic differences alone are usually unable to be these predictors of violence.
Now, you can have these factors, these fault lines go on for years and years. It seems to me, for example, you can have a huge constituency of losers that acquiesce to the situation up to a point, and then suddenly they waken. And that's when you seem to get the move towards violence. Is it a, Is it as they start to gain access to wealth? Is it as information about the unequal distribution becomes more evident? Is it as the, let's say, the constituency of winners become more abusive? What tends to ignite the constituency of losers and mobilize them?
Sure. I mean, let's just take, for example, let's say you were Tito, or you were Saddam Hussein, or you were Hosni Mubarak, or you were Muammar Gaddafi. What they would say in those societies is that it's only the strong man, the autocratic leader with an iron fist, who's able to keep these differences that would otherwise boil over into violence. Now that's, to some extent on the surface, might seem a credible argument in terms of when you look at recent history and you took away Tito, you took away Gaddafi, or you took away the Mobutu and the DRC and so forth. But in reality, over the long term, it's shown that it's actually democratic governments that are the best in terms of managing the divisions within those societies. So if we look at very, very intricate fault lines in countries like India or Brazil, now those two countries have not been free from violence, but given the complexity of those states, they've both done a fairly good job in terms of managing those fault lines.
Now, why were they able to do it? Because they are democracies?
Well, I think obviously in terms of from the Indian perspective, obviously Brazil experienced long periods of military rule. But I think that in terms of the institutions that are in place in those countries now, that those institutions are able to give these disparate groups some voice and have some redress when they don't get what they want in terms of the state. Now, I think that obviously those countries are still susceptible. I mean, Brazil, from a crime perspective, mostly in India, communal violence and so forth is never too far away. But I think, again, I think it's probably the way they manage those divisions and the way that they created robust institutions to help manage those differences. So good governance is very, very important.
Now, that phrase, governance, is right through, I think, every chapter. Talk more about the role of governance, good governance, poor governance.
Well,
I'm going to start on this. We've got about 2 minutes to break, so we get started on this.
Sure. I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think that democratic institutions, the rule of law, free and fair elections, independent judiciary, and so forth, in society, they provide real, genuine opportunities for groups to safeguard their interests and seek redress when their rights have been infringed. I think what success means in terms of the context of fault line management is not that these groups will always get what they want from the state, of course not, but rather that they don't resort to violence when they fail to get what they want because they believe that their interests are still best served by working through the state institutions. Now, all we have to do is contrast that with the behavior of both groups and governments and states that have experienced long periods of authoritarian rule, Sudan, Congo, Ethiopia, Nigeria, Iraq, Iran, Indonesia, to name only cases examined in this book. I mean, in some of those, the resort to armed conflict has been the first option nearly as often as the last. So I think that, you know, we can't underestimate the importance of good governance in terms of managing the fault line.
Now, I have a question, but we'll only get back to it when we get back from break. Time and again in the book, you point out that elections aren't the universal cure-all. And I want to know why, and I'm sure our readers do, because often that's the first thing that outside interveners go for. Let's have elections. But we'll find out why Sure. they're not the perfect cure when we get back from break. Don't go away.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616.
Are you and your family in debt? Today, over 40% of American households are spending more than they make. And that means our society is getting deeper and deeper in debt. Escape the debt trap with host and attorney Kenneth Neely is here to help you avoid the problems involved with debt, including rebuilding credit, filing bankruptcy, short selling your home, resolving IRS tax problems, and much more. Escape the Debt Trap airs live every Thursday at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm here with my guest, Dr. Terrence McNamee. We are talking about why some states fail, erupting in violence along the fault lines, and others survive, and what that means for your international business. When we went to break, Terrence, we were talking about elections. Why aren't elections a magic cure-all? We put such emphasis on them in the West.
You're absolutely right to hint at the fact that, elections are by no means a panacea. And what we're trying to argue in the book, certainly, is that it's the institutions that matter, and not, as many people seem to believe, elections per se. Now, of course, elections are, to a large extent, an intrinsic part of democracy and good governance. But they can, in many, many cases, particularly the ones that are examined in this book, be very problematic in the sense that they do not heal, but they do not serve to heal divided societies. But in fact, in some cases, they caused them to fracture further. Now, in the case of Africa, 20, 25 years ago, very few states had elections. But today, it is very much the opposite. Only very rare exceptions like Eritrea do not hold regular multi-party elections. Even in countries like Zimbabwe, they go through the election process, even though, of course, Zimbabwe and other places do not meet free and fair international standards for elections. But even the continent's most authoritarian leaders believe that it's elections that confer legitimacy today, so they can't do without them. But the problem is that in highly divided societies, elections can create an us versus them dynamic. And if the elections are viewed as fraudulent, as they often are in such societies, they can really seriously aggravate fault lines. So if we look at some recent cases, if we look at the DRC, the election has done absolutely nothing to heal the divisions within that society. In fact, I think the opposition leader, Tshisekedi, is still under house arrest. If we look at Angola, highly disputed election that brought Dos Santos into his his fourth decade in power in Angola.
Wasn't it the assumption that the elections were fraudulent that brought all the young people into the streets in Tehran?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we can look at, the case of Afghanistan, the 2010 election. Many, many countries have these elections when essentially what happens is that they do not in any way, shape, or form bring people together, but they actually serve to entrench the power and legitimacy of leaders who actually have no interest in addressing societal fault lines. Now, I'm not saying that is the case in Afghanistan and some other places, but it certainly is the case where we see 85% 90% voter support for incumbent candidates and so forth. And this has been a particular problem in this country. And you mentioned, sorry, not in this country, but in Rwanda, for instance. But you mentioned that with the international community, and you're very right, to them it often appears as a kind of quick deliverable, an indication of real progress. But that is, in fact, really more about often justifying themselves to their constituents back home rather than ameliorating the divisions in the country that they are supposed to be assisting. So we're certainly not arguing that elections are bad in all cases, far from it. But I think what we're arguing is that too little attention has been paid to other, arguably more important governance issues and mechanisms that can be more effective in helping countries address their fault lines, mechanisms like federalism and so forth, where power is devolved to regional or local authorities.
Now, talk about what other forms of democracy are really important. You just mentioned federalism. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, federalism, particularly, again, if I return to the African context, is so important in the sense that it has been shown to be of potentially immense value over the long term in terms of managing fault lines. And particularly countries who have been scarred by ethnic divisions and so forth, like Africa, which has a very unfortunate colonial inheritance where borders and so forth completely cut across, not just ethnic groups, but families and communities and so forth. But of course, federalism has to be more than just rhetoric, as it often is in places like Ethiopia or Uganda, who are nominally federal. You have to have proper mechanisms and perhaps especially viable revenue-sharing arrangements to produce successful long-term results. So if we look, for instance, in the case of Europe, we look at places like Italy, where you have the German-speaking province of Tyrol in northern Italy, which retains, I think, something like 90% of the taxes that are collected in that province. So those are the type of revenue-sharing arrangements which I think are particularly important, and these other types of federal arrangements. But we haven't really seen that genuine commitment to devolve power, at least in the African context. And, of course, federalism, it could be argued in cases like Canada, has been very effective in terms of managing the schism in that body.
So what we should be looking for, if we're looking at a country, whether we're going to be going in there or whether we are already doing business in a country, we should be looking for a form of federal government that actually gives power to the constituent units within the country. So would you consider you have a strong federalism in a country like Indonesia?
Well, I mean, Indonesia is a very interesting example, and I would think that Indonesia could lay claim to having turned the corner from 1998 and so forth. And perhaps, although, you know, these processes can be derailed, I think that for all the complexity of that society and its history of horrific violence, I think that it's doing a pretty good job, and it's done a very good job of managing the conflict in Aceh. And that's a very complex, and I'm certainly not an expert on Indonesia, but that is one of the case studies of the book, which my colleague Joseph Neal goes into. So I think that Indonesia is a very interesting case, Canada, other cases, but the key is it can't just be rhetoric. So in the case of Ethiopia, for instance, it's actually in its constitution that one of its autonomous regions or one of its provinces can secede from Ethiopia. However, in practice, that's not the case.
As you said, about half of the book looks at Africa, and I'd like to look at take a little more of a deep dive into Nigeria and then into Africa. And I just wanted to mention, you're the deputy director of the Johannesburg-based economic think tank, the Brenthurst Foundation, and we had a wonderful interview with your director, Greg Mills, and he talked about South Africa and Nigeria kind of being the hub for the new 21st century, being the century of Africa. So I'd like to talk a little bit about South Africa, which has been held up as, you know, such an example of a country that is healing its fault lines, and yet you said it's coming into one of its most difficult times. Can you tell us more about
it? Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So I think that South Africa, it is certainly full of paradoxes. In the one sense, it's the great, great example of fault line management. This is a country that transcended a racial divide which many people predicted would plunge the country into a kind of cataclysmic race war. And of course, that didn't happen. It didn't happen, I would say, principally because of the incredibly adroit and sound leadership of Nelson Mandela and others in that transition process, which was so important. So we saw South Africa, and it's held up as this great example of full mind management. But more recently, and as Greg argues in his chapter on South Africa, we are seeing new emergent fault lines, which of course are not entirely unrelated to race, but often they are more based on people who are permanently stuck in conditions of poverty, unemployment, and so forth. As you know, South Africa has one of the highest, if not the highest, Gini coefficient measure of inequality in the world, along with Brazil and a few other countries. So there's new emergent fault lines within South Africa, which are very, very worrying. And I think as South Africa gets near 20 years since 1994 and the birth of democracy, I think it's facing a whole raft of challenges in terms of uplifting the many millions of people who are seen to be completely stuck in these very, very desperately poor conditions. Whereas, of course, many, many people...
I was going to say, this is a country that's, of all the countries in Africa, has attracted the most international business. So I'd like you to go more into these challenges. I think that's really important. It's also the hub for basing in South Africa to do business in other African countries. So I'd like you to take this a bit further. What are the challenges, and what does business need to be aware of? And perhaps how can they address some of them?
Well, certainly from the South African perspective, if you are a foreign investor, there'd be a number of things to be mindful of. I'm not absolutely certain of my facts, but I think South Africa may rank near the top or the top country in the world in terms of the number of days lost to labor disputes and so forth. And of course, most recently, South Africa, in fact, is currently undergoing this wave of unrest that first occurred on the mines and now seems to be perhaps spreading to the agriculture sector in terms of some of the riots or unrest we're seeing in the farms in the Western Cape near Cape Town. So there's quite a lot of concerns if I was a foreign investor coming into this environment. Now, of course, South Africa has very strong labor regulations and so forth, and a lot of people have argued that it needs to relax those. But at the same time, you can understand from the unions and the labor sector that they are very concerned about uplifting people who really haven't had the kind of dividend that we expected in terms of the end of apartheid and so forth. Their GDP per capita and so forth for large numbers or large percentage of South Africa has not really increased since 1994. So there's very, very grave concerns. But at the same time, South Africa has such an incredible amount of expertise in particular sectors and particular fields. It has a very, very advanced financial sector. The mining skills in South Africa are virtually second to none. So South Africa does some things, and it exports a huge amount of talent, whether it's agriculture experts or whether it's mining or other technicians or financial people, right across the continent. So it has a huge amount going for it, South Africa. And in fact, it can be argued that South Africa, in terms of the size of its economy, perhaps produces the most global winners in the entire world in terms of major corporations. You think of SAB Miller and so forth. So it has a tremendous amount going for it. But right now, it's in a bit of a pickle. And I think that the government is searching for ways to try and get out of the morass it currently finds itself in. And there doesn't seem to be a clear way out of it now. And I think everyone is looking forward to the Christmas break to kind of reflect on this past year and think about different ways to get out of it.
We've got to go to break now. When we come back, I want to go back to Nigeria, a country with 250 distinct ethnic and linguistic communities, because it's such an important country, both from its oil-producing capability, but also it's kind of the business hub of West Africa. So don't go away, and we've got a lot to go for, including the fact I want to talk about, we have current predictions in the news about a potential new outbreak of war in the Middle East, and we've got the hot situation in Syria. So don't go away, we've got a lot more to cover.
Voice
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business. Are you a business innovator, or are you just sitting on the sidelines? Tune in every week for Coffee Break with Game Changers, presented by SAP. Host Bonnie D. Graham talks to a cross-section of the movers and shakers who are leading by example. They will share best practices and innovative ideas to keep you thinking and moving along with the best. Join us for Coffee Break with Game Changers, presented by SAP, Wednesday mornings at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, 8 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616. When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Tay Revez, and I'm here with Dr. Terrence McNamee, Deputy Director of the Johannesburg-based economic think tank, the Brenthurst Foundation. When we went to break, we were talking about South Africa, and I've actually gotten an email from one of our listeners, Lady Jill Murray from New York. She said, how could the black-led South African government fire on its own miners? Isn't that a betrayal of the entire movement? And where does it go from here?
Well, right now there is an inquiry going on in terms of the tragic events that occurred at Marikana. And just in case your listeners don't know, some unrest and killings led to a very horrific episode and one day in August in which I think 34 miners were gunned down in front of television cameras and so forth. But I think that we should probably await to the findings of that investigation before concluding who was to blame in terms of, you know, was it a police overreaction? Certainly a few police officers had just been recently killed there, and certainly some of the miners were armed with spears and axes and so forth. But I think we should probably just wait till the investigation until we find out what the situation is. But certainly your caller hints at the fact that those images that we saw on our screens, they actually seem to have echoes of horrible violence from the apartheid era, the Sharpeville killings, and so forth. So it's a terrible, terrible imagery, but I think we'll just wait for
the investigation. I think it wasn't just the images. It was the fact that miners were arrested and that many miners were fired, that it looks like the South African government is turning its back on its own labor movement. And I think that's disturbing.
Well, I think that the labor movement itself has undergone some convulsions. And I think there's probably a lack of consensus in terms of who is there a single representative for the labor movement, or is that beginning to fracture? Is a more radical element starting to come to the fore? So I think the questions relate to both internal in terms of the labor movement, but also in terms of where does labor fit in terms of the tripartite alliance.
Okay, let's turn to Nigeria because it is such an important state. I thought in the case, one of the sentences that struck me was this one. Nigeria elites sought to contain communal pressures through institutional engineering, informal bargaining over power sharing and rent distribution, changes to the political system that have been directed at providing a more inclusive process of governance and fiscal relations. I have vivid memories of the Biafra War, but we're also seeing, as you've mentioned, ongoing violence now. How are they managing it, and are we going to see Nigeria hold together?
I think the
chapters conclude with the hazards of failure are ever present.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think if I was to, you know, give you my prediction for what it's worth, I think Nigeria will. I think Nigeria has proven to be a very surprisingly resilient entity, given all of the divisions and fault lines that exist within that society. And we've seen that these terrible outbreaks of Muslim-Christian violence and these terrible incidents, but they have not triggered a major eruption on a north-south or a Muslim-Christian fault line. We don't see that. We don't see Boko Haram really able to mobilize a large popular constituency. In fact, Boko Haram has probably been as guilty for killing as many Muslims as they have Christians. So I think for all of its problems, for all of its divisions and occasional periods of chaos and its past periods of military rule and so forth, I think Nigeria is going to hang together. The question is that will all of the fairly optimistic predictions about its future economic success and prospects, will they really come to fruition? Nigeria is predicted to become a bigger economy than South Africa by 2020, I believe. But I think Nigeria faces a host of issues which it has not resolved. I mean, the extent of corruption and mismanagement and the fact that this is Africa's greatest oil producer, yet so many of its people are still mired in crushing poverty, speaks to a whole series of challenges in terms of governing that state. But on a positive note, after lurching from one military coup to another for so long, Nigeria now has an elected leadership. And, you know, I think it probably recognizes a lot of the challenges of governance that have really, really held it back. But Nigeria is a very strange place because on the one hand, if you have never been to Africa and you read these headlines comparing Nigeria to South Africa and you go, oh, well, Nigeria is a little bit similar to South Africa perhaps and it's going to have to surpass it. They're two entirely different states. I mean, you know, you could pick almost any road in South Africa and there probably isn't a road as good as that in Nigeria. I mean, the level of development and sophistication of the economies is totally different in terms of South Africa and Nigeria. So I think Nigeria probably presents a huge number of opportunities given the size of its population, its oil wealth, and so forth. But it hasn't really got its house together yet.
I want to turn to another of the cases in the book where there was a look at Tanzania, Uganda, and Kenya. And the author wrote that most African countries, two of the three critical variables, the extent of ethnic fractionalization and uneven development, remain unchanged, usually through a period of authoritarian rule, but that the factor that seems most predictive seems to be the approach that's taken by a country's political elite and the way that they interact with those two structural variables that will either accentuate the divisions or mitigate the fault lines. Can you talk about that?
Well, you know, I think you spoke to Joel Barkin's chapter, which covers Tanzania, Kenya, and Uganda, and he talks about this concept of ethnic fractionalization. It's a very sophisticated chapter, and trying to explain the relative stability of Tanzania in comparison to what we've seen in Uganda and certainly recently in Kenya. I think in the case of Kenya, it's incredibly worrying because we just spoke about Nigeria, and from a business perspective, well, Kenya is such an extraordinary opportunity because you have such a tremendous number of highly educated people, tremendous amount going for it in Kenya. Yet there really is a danger that as the election approaches in 2013, that you're going to have these very, very dangerous connections between corrupt leaders and so forth, ethnic groups. What we saw in 2007, at the end of 2007, 2008,
after the disputed election. We saw that outbreak of violence, which, of course, broke down to some extent along ethnic lines, but in reality it also crisscrossed all sorts of divisions within Kenya. But it's a very, very worrying time approaching the election, and I think that we've seen in parts of Kenya very, very recently very violent disputes over issues like cattle, and we could talk about things like access to water and so forth, which are these sort of local igniters of conflict, which can have, you know, strategic consequences. And we see that in the Horn of Africa a lot. But I think Joel's argument within that chapter is quite a sophisticated one, as I said. But I think that he points to some worrying signs that, particularly within Kenya and Uganda, who have not really managed these differences particularly well. And as we saw in Kenya in 2007, 2008, the sort of pressure curve just burst.
I want to turn now to the Middle East, which certainly has the hottest conflicts, both internally and across borders. And as I say, the news today is full of the question, are we going to see another hot Middle East war between Israel and the Palestinians? But you've got the Syrian conflict going on. You do have the whole Arab-Israeli. But the fault lines in the Middle East seem to be so complex and so deep. Where do you start to get a handle on them, particularly if you want to do business in the region?
Yeah, I mean, first, if we take Syria, I mean, obviously, the clamor for international intervention is starting to get louder. And one can understand that from what we see on our television screens and so forth. The difficulty, of course, that we have, and why so many people, notwithstanding the violence, are still signaling caution, is that we don't really know enough about the main drivers and igniters of that conflict. Yes, Syria is a dynastic ruled country by a small Shia sect in a largely Sunni country, and most of the violence in the past has been in the majority Sunni areas. But do we really understand the divisions within Syrian society? Do we understand the divisions within the opposition? And we've seen some trouble in terms of understanding and unpacking the opposition lately. So will we make things worse by intervening in that situation? Will we cause more bloodshed? Will we exacerbate those fault lines in Syria? And these are the really, really difficult questions that the decision makers, I think that France now seems to be leading
from the front.
That
was the conclusion that you drew out of the intervention in Iraq, that if the U.S. and the coalition that intervened against Saddam Hussein, and particularly post-invasion, you know, they had better understood Iraq's fault lines, then fewer lives would have been lost, particularly among the Iraqis.
Well, like all Kant counterfactuals, we can't know for certain, but if we just think back to after the initial combat phase had ended and Saddam's statue had come down, had the U.S.-led coalition understood the fault lines which divided Sunni from Shia, Arab from Kurd, and the other fault lines that were partially obscured under Saddam's tyranny, had the people in charge either paid more attention to them or understood them better, would less people have died? Would the tensions and divisions within Iraq have been managed more effectively? And I think we have to remember that in April 2003, most commentators unfamiliar with Iraq's complex internal dynamics, most of them assumed that the worst was over. But instead, the number of dead increased month on month, more or less steadily, for the next 4 years. So it's a counterfactual, but we have to think back to those times. And what if we had really, really took more seriously those divisions and took the time to understand them better before acting? And I think the experience of Iraq is signaling caution, I think, to the U.S. and others for Syria in terms of those particular divisions.
I was very struck by something Chris Brown, who authored the chapter on Iraq, wrote. He said, despite their deep divisions, their political achievements have been remarkable over the past 10 years. So, right, we've got to go to break now, but quick before we go to break, do you think Iraq is going to stay together?
Well, I think that the consequences of Iraq coming apart would be incredibly grave for the region, which so much effort has been put into keeping it together. But certainly, you know, we can look at these things if the half glass is half full or half
empty and where Iraq has come from. It has a huge number of problems, and we hope that we're not seeing the emergence of another kind of totalitarian leader there. But at the same time, you know, Chris Brown, he was a part of that, you know, as a military. He was number two to Odierno in 2008, so he had a real close perspective on the emerging governance, and that was his perspective. And not everyone would share his optimistic view on Iraq, but I think we'll have to see and wait.
Okay, we've got to go to break now. When we come back, we want to talk about how countries can emerge from violence and heal, and what is the role and the limitations on external actors, and of course, what the key takeaways are.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616.
We're always talking business. Talk to an expert. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back, everyone. This is the final segment of our Along the Fault Line show. I'm here with Dr. Terrence McNamee. What do you do? Because, of course, every business in the world is interested in China. Now, China's an outlier on the sort of the democracy growth, but they're seeing 250 to 500 protests per day, some of them pretty violent. Do they fall into your framework of analysis, or is it really just an outlier country?
Well, I think that China is an incredibly important case study, and it's not one that we dedicated a chapter to. But watching China as it goes forward is incredibly important. Now, the holy grail for Chinese leaders, and particularly this new leadership that has just come into being in the last few days, is internal unity. So internal unity in China and safeguarding that has always been the number one priority for Chinese leaders, because they recognize that there are all kinds of divisions within that country. Now, China faces lots of rural urban divisions between the haves and the have-nots. It, of course, does face some very high-profile ethnic divisions in terms of what we've seen in Tibet and what we've seen in the far western part of the country. But I think that the great concern probably for China in terms of from an internal fault line perspective will be this sort of increasing rural-urban divide that we're seeing. And, of course, the tremendously hyper-competitive economy that it is, the level of joblessness as China moves into the middle-income bracket becomes a lot less competitive, at least from a manufacturing perspective in terms of its rising labor costs and stuff. So I think China does have a lot to tell us about managing fault lines. And I think that China is an outlier in the sense that it does manages fault lines in an authoritarian way, and certainly not a democracy. But it also has these institutions of accountability at the local level and so forth that help it manage those fault lines, and that we don't see in the neo-patrimonial societies in Africa, that kind of local accountability. So China is a very interesting case study, and certainly if we were to do a volume two of this book, we would have it as a chapter.
Well, I want to switch to how we've seen relatively few countries emerge from violence, internecine fighting, but a few have. We've seen Northern Ireland, more recently we've seen Rwanda. What's the key factor or factors that will let a country heal? A couple of polls now, you've talked about South Africa, the extraordinary role of Nelson Mandela, and I think now the president of Rwanda is another one who really is dedicated to healing the wounds. But if you could have two or three bullet points, we don't have a lot of show left. What are the key factors that allow healing?
Firstly, it can't be emphasized enough, at least if you're from the outside looking in and you're trying to assist. One, we have to recognize people's and the fault lines which sometimes divide them for who and what they are, not what we may wish them to be. And I think that this was a point of the book that's aimed squarely at the international community, whose record of intervening without really first understanding what these fault lines and divisions are within society has on a number of occasions really only contributed to more deaths and exacerbated fault lines and so forth. So we just have to recognize these fault lines for what they are. And I think secondly, it's very important if you're from the outside looking in, is that the locals must own their own problems, and they must own the solutions to those problems. International intervention and so forth, and international assistance, it can be effective, but it's really often only effective at the edges. It can never really be decisive. So I think that it's inevitably down to local solutions, because it's the locals who frankly know best. And I think that too often we try and impose these templates from other conflicts and other wars and think they're going to work. And inevitably they don't. So I think that thinking about the local is all important, and recognizing, as I said, sort of people and the fault lines, just divide them for what they are and not what we may wish them to be.
So taking a realistic look at the countries and trying to draw as much information from the local people as possible before you make any decision. Is that?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's absolutely the case. And I think that often these issues, these big picture issues, really, they can be drilled down to things like access to water, access to grazing land. I'm talking within the African context. These are the real igniters of conflict that we see in places like Kenya, as I mentioned, South Sudan, which has experienced horrible violence in the past 18 months over these local issues. So we really need to understand what the local drivers of conflict are.
One of the things is we tend to talk about the fault lines as occurring within the nation state, but really a lot of these are very cross-border, and one that I'm thinking of right now is the case of the Kurds, who are across three countries. There are all kinds of fault lines in politics and potential conflicts between nation states ranging around that. I'm going to ask you to just give me 30 seconds on that, because I have a couple other questions I want to ask.
No, I think that's you're absolutely right. And not only do fault lines often crisscross regions like the Horn of Africa and other parts of the world, but the fact is we need regional solutions as well. So I talked just about the local, but neighbors are the ones who are affected by fault lines. And often it's the case that we think we've managed one fault line in a particular country, but actually we may have exacerbated another fault line. So this is this continual process of management. So we have the case in Sudan. By splitting Sudan into Sudan and South Sudan, for all of its problems, you did resolve one major issue, but a whole other series of issues have now sort of emerged in its wake. So we need to look at the regional and the way that countries are affected by a fault line in another country, neighboring countries, yes.
One of the things in your book you pointed out, I think was in the conclusion, that there are some external indicators that seem to be useful in one way or another, doing business indicators, transparency and corruption indices. Very briefly, because we've got about a minute and a half until close, How reliable are they? How useful are they for our audience?
They're important, they're reliable, and I think that they are getting even more traction, particularly within the African context. But I think that I would need to signal a note of caution. In 2010, in the Mo Ibrahim Governance Index, the country that was number 8, I think, was Tunisia, number 9 was Egypt, and number 23, so in the top half of Africa, was Libya. Now, we all know what happened to those countries within months of the issuance of that Good Governance Index. So we need to be very, very careful about these indices. And we often find that in countries like Rwanda and so forth, they are relentlessly pursuing their movement up the rankings on doing business, ease of doing business, and so forth, which I think to a large extent is a good thing. But I think that we can't have government buy these indices. We need to have a holistic approach and not just sort of chase these particular things. We need to think about the whole picture. So I think that they're good, and I think Freedom House and Mo Ibrahim, and it's all good, but I think that we have to be very mindful that it's not the whole story.
I have to say, back in my murky past when I was at Business International, we spent months putting together political risk indices, and it was politics, economics, and social and infrastructure, and it was fiendishly difficult, and I wonder how successful it was. But is it useful for our audience? And we've got 1 minute to close, so I've got one quick question after that. Is it something that our business audience should...
And it's very, very important. It's very important as to understand, for instance, if we take Freedom House, and in terms of their scaling about partly free and so forth. I think that's very, very important, because we can't just look, for instance, that, oh, they've had an election, so they're largely democratic. That's not the case. So I think, so, for instance, Freedom House would be a good example in terms of understanding the governance challenges and issues that a business, an investor might encounter in those countries. So I think, yeah, very useful.
So quick before we go, repeat the name of your book and tell us the publisher. I know we can get it on Amazon, and tell me where else we can get it.
Sure. It's called On the Fault Line, Managing Tensions and Divisions Within Societies. We have a great publisher, Profile Books, of London, and I think you can get it at bookstores in the States and on Amazon.
And I really recommend this to anybody engaged on the international scene. It is a profound book. I learned a tremendous amount about countries I thought I knew about. Terrence, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. I think this was a terrific subject and tremendously important. I think the work you've done there is tremendously important.
Thanks so much, Dave. My pleasure.
And just before we go, if you're in the Northeast region, please donate to one of the organizations such as the American Red Cross that are doing relief from Hurricane Sandy. The devastation is still massive and there are people still struggling. I want to thank you all for joining us. Next week is Thanksgiving. I want to wish you all a happy Thanksgiving. And this show is going to be rebroadcast on Thanksgiving. Please get back to us. We'll be back after Thanksgiving with a brand new show.
Thank you for listening to Global Reach with Tay Revez. Please join us again next Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Have a great week.